jaw better. Major facepalm. This was all a big wake-up call for me. I made a commitment to start building trust and connection with the people I worked with each day by simply engaging with them for a few minutes on a personal level, asking them about this or that, and genuinely being interested in their personal lives or details that they wanted to share. I'm a good listener, and I'm usually able to engage well one-on-one. This initially felt a little weird for me and was not easy for me to do. I tend to avoid personal encounters, and I've tended to divide the work world from the rest of my life world. Over time, these interactions became easier. I made it a priority each day to engage each person in the office for however long was naturally appropriate. I started to show up as a colleague. I saw my coworkers less as competition or inept. I started to see everyone as people who were doing the best they could, just like I was doing. Over the last several months, trust and connection have grown. I feel more a sense of being part of a team and have engaged in more sharing of professional efforts as well. Running parallel with these coworker relationship building efforts was becoming aware that I had a fear I had held on to for quite a few years, a cave I didn't want to enter, but now knew I needed to. My backstory on this. Years ago, I had started a PhD. It was a dream to accomplish this, but unfortunately, everything went wrong that could go wrong. I ended up dropping my program, getting a divorce, withdrawing from the world for a period, returning home, and eventually remarrying and starting a family. I tried to return to my PhD work at one point, but ultimately dropped it again in order to focus on my children and wife and my full-time job. I have carried around this sense of I'm not enough due to the absence of achieving my doctorate. Fast forward to a time period a few months ago when I had been tracking and analyzing data from a 7-year education project that I had designed and implemented. I had discovered some very interesting patterns and outcomes. Some of these results are scant or non-existent in the literature. I had hesitated for several years to submit this type of work to a professional conference and present it to the scientific community. The old voice saying, you don't belong in that group, you don't have your PhD, they won't take you seriously, kept me down. But I made a decision to submit the research work I had painstakingly conducted. My abstract was selected, and I joined a conference where I knew not a single soul. I was an outsider. However, I experienced a sense of belonging, that these people might be my people, my tribe. What resulted is that my work was taken seriously, and I received genuine interest from others in this scientific community. Another positive outcome of that decision is that in order for me to travel and participate in that science conference, I had to let go of something that I'd held on to with a very tight grip for the past 7 years. I had organized and run a successful annual workshop from top to bottom. Every tiny aspect of it was under my control. The workshop had originally been planned for the same week as the conference where I wanted to present my results. I reached out to my coworkers, one in particular, and asked her if she would consider co-chairing the workshop with me. I said we could open up a larger chunk of the workshop to integrate some of her ideas. Though we'd been competitive, we worked together very well, and I learned a lot from her efforts, and she learned a lot from running the workshop in my absence. We both gained each other's respect, and we felt like a team after that. Trust was built. Through all of this experience the last 6 months, I've come to realize some important things. I had shown up, put myself out there, and entered the cave. Only by showing up and being vulnerable was any of this possible. I couldn't have done this as a lone wolf. I presented myself authentically. I reached out and made connections. I shared. I realized that I'm a part of the larger science community and that I'm enough. I don't need to attach my personal worth to what I produce. I bring a unique set of experiences and wisdom, and I can contribute as part of a team. I love this story from Brent. You know, we can never overestimate the relationship between self-trust and trusting others. Maya Angelou said, I don't trust people who don't love themselves and tell me I love you. There's an African saying, which is, be careful when a naked person offers you a shirt. Part 4, Learning to Rise. We have to teach people how to land before they jump. When you go skydiving, you spend a lot of upfront time jumping off a ladder and learning how to hit the ground without hurting yourself. I have not experienced this personally, but I've watched. The same is true in leadership. We can't expect people to be brave and risk failure if they're not prepped for hard landings. One of the most unexpected findings that emerged from the leadership research is about the timing of teaching skills for rising or resilience. Often, leaders and executive coaches gather people together and try to teach resilience skills after there's been a setback or failure. It turns out that that's like teaching first-time skydivers how to land after they hit the ground, or maybe worse, as they're free-falling. Our research shows that leaders who are trained in rising skills as part of a courage-building program are more likely to engage in courageous behaviors because they know how to get back up. Not having those skills in place is a deterrent to braver leadership, and teaching people how to get up once they're already on the ground is much more difficult. This is why we teach falling and failing up front. In fact, in our organization, we teach falling as part of courage building during onboarding. It's our way of saying, we expect you to be brave. That means you should expect to fall. We've got a plan. While the merits of failing and falling have received some global attention in the last couple of years, I seldom see the fall forward or fail fast slogans put into practice alongside actual reset skills and honest rumbles about the shame that almost always accompanies failure. Mere slogans without teaching skills and putting systems in place are a half-assed attempt at normalizing. It leaves people thinking, God, this is painful, but I think I'm supposed to feel innovative. Now I have shame about feeling shame. I guess better keep that a secret. Today, with millennials making up 35% of the American labor force, the largest represented generation, teaching how to embrace failure as a learning opportunity is even more important. I've been in the university classroom for 20 years, and I've observed that the resilience and balance of some students have decreased while the exposure to trauma for others has increased. On the one hand, we were and are constantly intervening, constantly fixing, constantly helping some kids. As the head of my son's school said, many parents have gone from helicopter parents to lawnmower parents. Instead of preparing the child for the path, we prepared the path for the child. That's definitely not courage building. On the other hand, we've raised our kids on a steady stream of pervasive and systemic violence against marginalized communities, a vitriolic social media environment, and monthly active shooter drills at school. Today, some young adults are overprotected, while others are grossly underprotected. Some are paralyzed by perfectionism and what other people think, while others have found it physically and emotionally safer to shut down or armor up. Either way, it feels like we're failing young adults, and it's easy to understand why many of them are entering the workforce without grounded confidence and rumbling skills. Millennials make up 48% of our staff, and including interns, it's 56%. They are all very different people, but as a group, I experience them as curious, hopeful, always learning, painfully attuned to the suffering in the world, and anxious to do something about it. Because perspective is a function of experience, as a group, they can struggle with patience and understanding how long it takes to cultivate meaningful change. It's our job to help give them the experiences that broaden their perspectives. When they complete our Daring Leadership program as part of their onboarding, almost every millennial who works with us has told me some version of, first, I've never learned how to have these kinds of conversations. I never learned about emotions or how to talk so openly about failure, and I've never seen it modeled. Second, when you're used to using technology for everything, these hard face-to-face conversations are awkward and so intense. The only real exceptions are employees who have had experience in therapy, which is one reason we have a special reimbursement program for mental health visits on top of our regular health insurance. My experience is that millennials and Gen Zers lean in and lean hard. They're starving for the ability to put courage into practice. I'm a pretty typical Gen Xer, and I'm starving for it too. I think we all are. But I do think some of us got more of it growing up than we've modeled and taught today's young adults. Here's the bottom line. If we don't have the skills to get back up, we may never risk falling. And if we're brave enough, often enough, we're definitely going to fall. The research participants who have the highest levels of resilience can get back up after a disappointment or fall. And they're more courageous and tenacious as a result of it. They do that with a process I call learning to rise. It has three parts: the reckoning, the rumble, and the revolution. My goal for this part of the book is to give you the language, tools, and skills that make up the essentials of this process so you can immediately start putting this work into practice. The research is profound in its potential impact. It's almost a neurobiological hack for your brain. I'm going to walk you through this process with a story, because I don't think there's a better way to introduce the reckoning, the rumble, and the revolution. The ham foldover debacle. A few years ago, in the midst of growing my companies, I decided that within a 3-week period in September, I would launch a new company, go on a book tour, and skill up 1,500 people who are trained in my work. I decided in February that this was a great idea. As we've discussed, the part of my brain that accounts for timing is missing, which seems to be a scientific fact. When I made this announcement to my team and Steve, they all pushed back, but I had a secret weapon that I was keeping to myself. By September, I'm going to be an instructor-level Pilates person and ready to run some half marathons. That way, I'll have 10 times the energy I have now, and this will be easy peasy lemon squeezy. Well, August arrived. Difficult, difficult, lemon, difficult. The wheels had completely fallen off my life, both at home and at work. I had been to one Pilates class that I hated, and I was still run-walking the same 3-mile route I had for years. I commandeered the dining room of my house, which looked like a crime scene. Things were taped up all over the wall, piles of loose paper and boxes covered every inch of our table. I had stacks of stock photos and font sheets to sift through for a new website, and training materials everywhere. It was pure chaos. I was sitting in the dining room on the brink of collapsing in tears when I heard the back door open and Steve come in. He walked down the hall, headed into the kitchen, set his bag down on the breakfast room table, and opened the refrigerator. The very first thing I heard him say was, "We don't even have any damn lunch meat in this house." In the past, when telling this story to an audience, I've asked them for their reaction to his damn lunch meat comment. Without fail, women in the audience shout out comments that range from, "Get your own lunch meat," and "It's always our fault," to "Give her a break." One woman shouted, "Leave him," which, you know, that felt like a strong choice. In reality, my first thought was, what did he just say? I clenched my jaws and tightened my fists. I cannot believe he'd be so shitty. I walked into the kitchen and said, "Hey, babe," but not in the nice way. I did it with a voice and tone that have launched 1,000 fights in kitchens across the globe. He responded with little wariness and a little hopefulness. "Hey, what's up?" "You know that big old truck you drive?" I asked. "Yeah," he responded, wariness overtaking hopefulness at this point. "I bet if you point it west and you go about 1.5 miles, you're going to run into a big-ass HEB grocery store. And I bet if you go in there and give them your credit card, they will give you a bag of ham." At this point, I was very pleased with myself. Steve looked less impressed and more worried. "Oh man, Brene, did you leave your credit card at HEB again?" "Damn it." He was totally killing my jam. "No, I did not lose my credit card. I'm just saying that you can get your own lunch meat." He looked at me with genuine worry. "Geez, are you okay?" Yes, I'm okay. I understand that it's 6:30 and you're pissed off that there's no dinner on the table. I get it. Wait, what? He asked. I repeated myself. I understand it's 6:30, you're hungry, dinner's not on the table. I get it. He looked at me and said, okay, Brene, what's 30 times 365? I was like, oh my God, on top of everything else, he's math shaming me. This is a total takedown. I looked at him with that look that you get when you feel just a little bit unhinged. You know what? You want to dance, Steve? We'll dance. In my most sarcastic voice, I answered, I don't know, Steve. What is 30 times 365? Completely refusing to engage, he said, I don't know either, but it's the number of days we've been together. And in that number of days, not once, not whatever that big number is, have I ever come home and seen dinner on the table? Not once. He went on. Number one, if I came home and dinner was on the table, I'd think one of two things was happening. One, you're either leaving me, or two, someone in our family is really sick. Second thing, when we cook dinner, we do it together. Number three, who's done the grocery shopping in this family for like the last 5 years? I thought to myself, damn it to hell. This is not following the script for the movie in my head. I shrugged and kicked at the ground like a toddler. Well, you, I guess. I mean, you buy the groceries. Still calm and more curious than pissed, he said, right, I get the groceries. So what's going on? There's a sentence that hovered over my data for about 10 years, but I never investigated it because it didn't really saturate across all of the interviews. However, when I was interviewing and coding data for Rising Strong, the research participants who demonstrated the highest level of resilience used some form of these sentences. The story I'm telling myself. The story I make up. I make up that. If you put one rising skill into practice, start with this one. It's a game changer. In fact, I'm so sure of it that I'll risk the possibility of overpromising by saying it has the power to transform the way you live, love, parent, and lead. Just watch how it works. Back in my kitchen in Houston, I looked at Steve and said, look, the story I'm telling myself right now is this. I'm a half-ass leader, a half-ass mom, a half-ass wife, and a half-ass daughter. I am currently disappointing every single person in my life. Not because I'm not good at what I do, but because I'm doing so many different things that I cannot do a single one of them well. What I'm making up in my head right now is that you want to make sure that I know that you know how bad things suck right now. It's like you need to announce how sucky things are in our house on the off chance that I, the purveyor of everything that's currently sucking, happens not to know. Steve looked at me and said, you know what? I get it. I know you're making that up because that's your go-to story when you're in a hard place. And you're in a harder place than I have seen you in years. The work you have in front of you is beyond human scale. You are so far under the water, you can't even find your way to the top right now. So here's what we're going to do. I'm diving down. I'm going to find you. I'm going to pull you to the surface because when I'm lost, you always find me and you pull me to the surface. And then we'll feed the kids Chick-fil-A for day number four. Maybe we'll add some spinach just to make our way into parenting purgatory. And then we will sort this out. We will sort this out together. By this point, I was crying. Thank you. I'm so overwhelmed and I do not know what to do next. I cannot dig myself out of this. It's too much. It's so much. People are depending on me. Steve gave me a long bear hug, and when I pulled away to wipe the snot off my face, I looked up at him and said, can I ask you an honest question, though? He said, yeah, of course, as he pushed the hair off my face. Why the big proclamation at the refrigerator? Why the, we don't even have any damn lunch meat in this house, announcement? Was that a jab? I mean, it's okay if it was. I get it. But was it a little dig at me, or maybe just the situation we're in? Steve said, let me think about it. He's a very sincere guy, and I thought he'd come back with, yeah, I'm kind of sick of the stress. It was a little passive-aggressive, but instead, he said, I'm so hungry. What do you mean? I asked, totally confused. I'm just hungry. I said it because I'm hungry. I got stuck with a patient at lunch. And on the way home today, I thought to myself, well, we probably won't eat until 7. I'm going to make a ham foldover. Still confused, I said, and? He looked at me. And nothing. That's it. I'm hungry for a ham foldover. The ham foldover debacle. I'm guessing every person with this book in their hand or everyone who's listening on audio has experienced the equivalent of a ham foldover debacle. You make yourself the center of something that has nothing to do with you out of your own fear or scarcity, only to be reminded that you're not the axis on which the world turns. And that's not just one of the oldest maneuvers in history. It's our brain at work. Ironically, trying to keep us safe. Holding this story in mind, let's break down the 3-step process for learning to rise. The reckoning, the rumble, and the revolution. The learning to rise process is about getting up from our falls, overcoming our mistakes, and facing hurt in a way that brings more wisdom and wholeheartedness into our lives. As tough as it is, the payoff is huge. When we have the courage to walk into our story and own it, we get to write the ending. And when we don't own our stories of failure, setbacks, and hurt, they own us. I call the research participants who had the highest level of resilience and reset the risers. It just fits. Plus, I always think about the arena when I hear the chorus to the song Riser by Dierks Bentley. I'm a riser. I'm a get up off the ground, don't run and hider. Pushing comes to shove, and hey, I'm a fighter. The reckoning. We are emotional beings, and when something hard happens to us, emotion drives. Cognition or thinking is not sitting shotgun next to behavior in the cab of the truck. Thinking and behavior are hogtied in the back, and emotion is driving like a bat out of hell. Picture me at the dining room table when Steve makes the damn ham announcement. Risers immediately recognize when they're emotionally hooked by something. Hey, something's got me. And then they get curious about it. We don't have to pinpoint the emotion accurately. We just need to recognize that we're feeling something. There will be time to sort out exactly what we're feeling later. Some of the ways risers talk about knowing they were hooked include, I don't know what's happening right now, but I'm coming out of my skin. Or, man, I cannot stop playing that conversation over and over in my head. Or, how did I end up in the pantry? Sometimes risers will just think, God, I feel really fill in the blank, disappointed, regretful, pissed, hurt, heartbroken, confused. Or they'll say, I'm in a lot of pain. I'm feeling vulnerable. I'm in a shame storm. I'm embarrassed. I'm overwhelmed. I'm in a world of hurt. Sometimes a riser might say, you know what? My stomach is in knots. Or I want to punch someone. The reckoning is as simple as that. Knowing that we're emotionally hooked and then getting curious about it. The challenge is that very few of us were raised to get emotionally curious about what we're feeling. Whether it's a failure, a sideways comment from a colleague, a meeting that is full of disconnection and frustration, or a feeling of rising resentment when we're asked to do more than someone else, we're hooked. And we weren't taught the skill that the most resilient among us share. Slow down, take a deep breath, and get curious about what's happening. Instead, we bust out the armor. While most of us get busy sucking it up, ignoring our feelings, or taking out our emotions sideways on other people, for example, marching into the kitchen loaded for bear, the risers are getting curious about what's really going on so they can dig in, figure out what they're feeling, and why. It's kind of like thinking before you talk, but it's feeling before you swing or hide. How do we recognize that we've been snagged by emotion? From the wisest part of us, our body. We call emotions feelings because we feel them in our bodies. We have a physiological response to emotions. Risers are connected to their bodies, and when emotion knocks, they feel it and they pay attention. For example, since putting this work into practice, I learned that when I'm emotionally hooked, time slows down. My armpits tingle, my mouth gets dry, and I immediately start playing whatever has happened on a continuous loop in my head. Now, so when any of those things happens, I try to pay attention and take it as a cue. My cue is personalized for me. Something is going on. Get curious or get crazy. If I think back to the ham foldover debacle, the clenched jaw, and the balled up fists, we're probably a good sign. Here's the hard news about this process. Very few people make it through the reckoning for one reason. Instead of feeling our emotions and getting curious, we offload our emotions onto other people. We literally take that ball of emotional energy welling up inside us and hurl it toward other people. I'm going to share the 6 most common offloading strategies from Rising Strong. As you hear them, ask yourself 2 questions. 1, do I do this? And 2, how does it feel to be on the receiving end of this? Offloading strategy number 1, chandeliering. We think we've packed the hurt so far down that it can't possibly resurface. Yet all of a sudden, a seemingly innocuous comment sends us into a rage or sparks a crying fit. Or maybe a small mistake at work triggers a huge shame attack. Perhaps a colleague's constructive feedback hits that exquisitely tender place and we jump out of our skin. I learned the term chandelier from Steve. It's used within the medical community to describe a patient's pain that is so severe that if you touch that tender place, their response is involuntary. No matter how hard they try to hide the hurt or how distracted they are by other things, they jump to the ceiling or chandelier. The chandeliering I'm describing is the emotional equivalent, and it's especially common and dangerous in power over situations. In environments where, because of power differentials, people with a higher position or status are less likely to be held accountable for flipping out or overreacting. This type of volatility creates distrust and disengagement. For example, someone might maintain their prized stoicism in front of customers or other people they want to impress or influence. But the second they're around people over whom they have emotional, financial, or physical power, they explode. And because it's not a behavior seen by many of the higher-ups, their version of the story is usually perceived as truth. We see power over chandeliering in families, churches, schools, communities, and offices. And when you mix in issues like gender, class, race, sexual orientation, or age, the combination can be toxic. Most of us have been on the receiving end of such outbursts. Even if we have the insight to know that our boss, friend, colleague, or partner blew up at us because something tender was triggered, and even when we know it's not actually about us, it still shatters trust and respect. Living, growing up, working, or worshiping on eggshells creates huge cracks in our sense of safety and self-worth. Over time, these cracks can be experienced as trauma, whether this happens at work or at home. Offloading strategy number 2, bouncing hurt. Pain is hard, and it's easier to be angry or pissed off than to acknowledge hurt. So our ego intervenes and does the dirty work. The ego doesn't own stories or want to write new endings. It denies emotion and hates curiosity. Instead, the ego uses stories as armor and alibi. The ego says, feelings are for losers and weaklings. Like all good hustlers, our ego employs crews of ruffians in case we don't comply with its demands. Anger, blame, and avoidance are the ego's bouncers. When we get too close to recognizing an experience as an emotional one, these 3 spring into action. It's much easier to say, I don't give a damn, than it is to say, I'm hurt. The ego likes blaming, finding fault, making excuses, inflicting payback, and lashing out, all of which are ultimately forms of self-protection. The ego is also a fan of avoidance, assuring us that we're fine, pretending that it doesn't matter, that we're impervious. We adopt a pose of indifference or stoicism, or we deflect with humor and cynicism. Whatever. Who cares? None of this matters anyway. When the bouncers are successful, when anger, blame, and avoidance push away real hurt, disappointment, or pain, our ego is free to scam all at once. Often the first hustle is shaming others for their lack of emotional control. The ego can be a conniving and dangerous liar when it feels threatened. Offloading strategy number 3, numbing hurt. We talked a lot about numbing in the section on the armory. The important thing to note here is that in addition to numbing being a popular form of armor, we can offload emotion through it as well. Offloading strategy number 4, stockpiling hurt. There's a quiet, insidious alternative to chandeliering, bouncing, or numbing hurt. We can stockpile it. We're not erupting with misplaced emotions or using blame to deflect our true feelings or numbing the pain. Stockpiling starts like chandeliering, by firmly packing down the pain. But instead of unleashing it on another person, we just continue to amass hurt until our bodies decide that enough is enough. The body's message is always clear. Shut down the stockpiling or I'll shut you down. The body wins every time. Midlife and mid-career are often when we start to see the effects of having stockpiled emotion for too long. The body is holding down the emotional fort, and as a result, we can experience many symptoms, including anxiety, depression, burnout, insomnia, and physical pain. Offloading strategy number 5, the Umbridge. I named this strategy after J.K. Rowling's character Dolores Umbridge in Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, and I find it to be one of the most difficult offloading strategies to experience. Played brilliantly by Imelda Staunton in the films, Umbridge wears cutesy pink suits and pillbox hats, adorns her pink office with bows and trinkets decorated with kittens, and is a fan of torturing children who misbehave. Rowling writes about her, a love of all things saccharine often seems present where there is a lack of real warmth or charity. Too many cheery claims like, everything's awesome, or, you know, I just never really feel angry or upset, or, if you're just positive, you can turn that frown upside down, often mask real pain and hurt. What's true but seems counterintuitive is that we don't trust people who don't struggle, who don't have bad days or hard times. We also don't develop connection with people we don't find relatable. When light and dark are not integrated, overly sweet and accommodating can feel foreboding, as though under all that niceness is a ticking bomb. Offloading strategy number 6, hurt and the fear of high centering. Please do not Google the term high-centered. More than likely, you'll pull up an image of a cow stuck on top of a fence, legs dangling on both sides, unable to move forward or go backward. It's very disturbing. I learned the term because my grandmother's driveway in San Antonio was two parallel cement strips with a mound of dirt and grass in the middle. Every now and then, my grandmother would say, "The dirt and grass are getting too high. I'm going to get high-centered in my car." And we dig out and flatten that center strip with a shovel. High-centered here meant that the center of the car would be higher than the four tires, and she'd get stuck. One reason we deny our feelings is the fear of getting emotionally high-centered. That is, getting stuck in a way that makes it difficult to go forward or backward. If I recognize my hurt or my fear or my anger, I'll get stuck. Once I engage even a little, I won't be able to move backward and pretend that it doesn't matter. But moving forward might open a floodgate of emotion that I can't control. Recognizing emotion leads to feeling emotion. What if I recognize the emotion and it dislodges something and I can't maintain control? I don't want to cry at work or on the battlefield or when I'm with my students. Getting high-centered can be the worst, because we feel a total loss of control. We feel powerless. Strategies for reckoning with emotion. This is going to sound weird, but the most effective strategy for staying with emotion, instead of offloading it, is something I learned from a yoga teacher and a few members of the military special forces. It's breathing. The yoga teacher called it box breathing. The soldiers called it tactical breathing. Turns out, they're the same thing. Former Green Beret Mark Miller explains tactical breathing this way. Number one, inhale deeply through your nose, expanding your stomach for a count of four. Hold in that breath for the count of four. Slowly exhale all the air through your mouth, contracting your stomach for a count of four. Then hold the empty breath for a count of four. Because you've got the audiobook and we can do this together, let's try it for just a minute together. Ready? Inhale deeply through your nose for the count of four. Hold that breath. One, two, three, four. Exhale for the count of four. And then hold the exhale. One, two, three, four. We don't take enough deep breaths at work. We don't pause enough and check our body. I'm a breath holder, and sometimes when things get really hectic and I'm in firefighting mode at the office, I just stop and trace a square on my desk. In for four, hold for four, out for four, hold for four. I swear just two or three of these breathing sessions rewires me. I've even taught my kids and students how to do it. Breathing is also the key to another strategy for reckoning with emotion, and one of the most underrated leadership superpowers, practicing calm. I define calm as creating perspective and mindfulness while managing emotional reactivity. Calm is a superpower because it's the balm that heals one of the most prevalent workplace stressors, anxiety. When it comes to anxiety, my greatest teacher is psychologist Harriet Lerner. In her book, The Dance of Connection, Dr. Lerner explains that we all have patterned ways of managing anxiety. Some of us respond by overfunctioning and others by underfunctioning. Overfunctioners, like myself, tend to move quickly to advise, rescue, take over, micromanage, and get into other people's business rather than look inward. Underfunctioners tend to get less competent under stress. They sometimes invite others to take over and often become the focus of family gossip, worry, or even concern. They can get labeled the irresponsible one or the problem child or the fragile one. Dr. Lerner explains that seeing these behaviors as pattern responses to anxiety, rather than truths about who we are, can help us understand that we can change. For those of us who overfunction, our work is to become more willing to embrace our vulnerabilities in the face of anxiety. For folks who underfunction, the goal is to work on amplifying strengths and competencies. Whether we over or underfunction, practicing calm creates the clearing we need to get emotionally grounded. The bad news is that anxiety is one of the most contagious emotions that we experience. This explains why anxiety can so easily become a function of groups, not individuals. It's too contagious to stay contained in one person. We've all had that experience of one person sending a group into a tailspin. The good news? Calm is equally contagious. Over the past 20 years, the most proficient practitioners of calm that I've interviewed all talked about the important and weird combination of breathing and curiosity. They talked about taking deep breaths before responding to questions or even asking them, slowing down the pace of a frantic conversation by modeling slow speech, breathing, and fact-finding, and even intentionally taking a few breaths before asking themselves a version of these two questions. One, do I have enough information to freak out about the situation? Number two, if I do have enough data, will freaking out help? In addition to curiosity and breathing, don't forget permission slips. Sometimes we have to give ourselves permission to feel, especially if we come from a family where exploring and discussing emotion was either explicitly off-limits or just not modeled. Imagine how different my conversation with Steve would have been if I had paid attention to my anger and hurt, taken a few deep breaths, and become curious. The Rumble. Conspiracies, confabulations, and shitty first drafts. If the reckoning is how we walk into a tough story, the rumble is where we go to the mat with that story and own it. The rumble starts with this universal truth. In the absence of data, we will always make up stories. It's how we're wired. Meaning-making is in our biology. And when we're in struggle, our default is often to come up with a story that makes sense of what's happening and gives our brain information on how best to self-protect. This happens 100 times a day at work. Our organizations are littered with stories that people make up because they don't have access to information. If you've ever led a team through change, you know how much time, money, energy, and engagement bad stories cost. Robert Burton, a neurologist and novelist, explains that our brains reward us with dopamine, that aha moment, when we recognize incomplete patterns. Stories are patterns. The brain recognizes the familiar beginning, middle, and end structure of a story and rewards us for clearing up the ambiguity. Unfortunately, the brain rewards us for a good story, one with clear good guys and bad guys, regardless of the accuracy of the story. The promise of that, aha, I've solved it sensation, can seduce us into shutting down the uncertainty and vulnerability that are often necessary for getting to the truth. The brain is not a big fan of ambiguous stories that leave unanswered questions and a big tangle of possibilities. The brain has no interest in, maybe I have a part, or am I blowing this out of proportion? The part of the brain that goes into protection mode likes binaries, good guy, bad guy, dangerous, safe, ally, or enemy. Burton writes, because we are compelled to make stories, we are often compelled to take incomplete stories and run with them. He goes on to say that even with a half story in our minds, we earn a dopamine reward every time it helps us understand something in our world, even if that explanation is incomplete or wrong. The first story we make up is what we call the shitty first draft, or the SFD. If you're not comfortable with shitty, I call it the stormy first draft with kids. They totally get this concept and love talking about their SFDs because after a hard experience, it gives them the opportunity to confirm that we love them and that they still belong. The idea of a shitty first draft comes from Anne Lamott's exceptional book on writing, Bird by Bird. She writes, "The only way I can get anything written at all is to write really, really shitty first drafts. The first draft is the child's draft, where you let it all pour out and then let it romp all over the place, knowing that no one is going to see it and that you can shape it later." When it comes to our emotions, the first stories we make up, our SFDs, are definitely our fears and insecurities romping all over the place, making up worst-case scenarios. For example, Steve's a total jerk. He doesn't think I'm capable of running my business and being a great partner and mom. He's sick of me, and he's sick of the stress. You know what? The past 30 years have been a giant lie. Instead of plowing into the kitchen like a bull in an emotional china shop, I wish I had noticed my reaction to the ham comment and become curious about the emotions eating me up. Had I taken the time to surface my SFD, I could have walked in and said, "Hey, I heard the ham comment, and the story I'm telling myself is that you're sick of me and all this stress going on at work right now." I've known Steve for more than 30 years, and I'm 99% confident that he would have pulled me in for a hug and said, "I know you're overwhelmed. What can we do?" Yes, the conflict worked out okay, but relationships can take only a certain amount of what I pulled in the kitchen before they're affected by it. In our SFDs, fear fills in the data gaps. What makes that scary is that stories based on limited real data and plentiful imagined data blended into a coherent, emotionally satisfying version of reality are called conspiracy theories. Yes. We are all conspiracy theorists with our own stories, constantly filling in data gaps with our fears and insecurities. In work cultures, where there's a lot of change and confusion afoot, teams go crazy with SFDs. However, if you're operating in a culture of courage, you give people as many facts as you can, and when you can't tell them everything, you acknowledge that you're telling them as much as you can and that you'll continue to keep them in the loop with information as you have access to it and have permission to share. Clear is kind, and clarity absolutely reduces story making and conspiracy theories. Daring leaders ask for SFDs. They create the time, space, and safety for people to reality check their stories. In the past, when we've had to let people go, we've met privately with the immediate team affected, made the announcement to the larger group, then invited people to come see us during a blocked out time to talk, ask questions, and check SFDs. Keep in mind, you can spend a reasonable amount of time attending to the feelings and fears and conspiracy theories, or you can squander an unreasonable amount of time managing unproductive behaviors. In addition to attending to conspiracy theories, we also have to watch for confabulations. Confabulation has a really great and subtle definition. A confabulation is a lie told honestly. To confabulate is to replace missing information with something false that we believe to be true. In his book, The Storytelling Animal, Jonathan Gottschall explains that there's growing evidence that ordinary, mentally healthy people are strikingly prone to confabulate in everyday situations. In one of my favorite studies described in his book, a team of psychologists asked shoppers to choose a pair of socks from a set of 7 pairs and then give their reasons for choosing that particular pair. Every shopper explained their choice based on subtle differences in color, texture, and stitching. No shopper said, "I don't know why this is my choice," or "I have no idea why I picked that one." All of them had a full story that explained their decision. But here's the kicker. All of the socks were identical. Gottschall explains that all of the shoppers told stories that made their decisions seem rational. But they really weren't. He writes, "The stories were confabulations, lies honestly told." Confabulation shows up at work when we share what we believe is factual information, but it's really just our opinion. It's when I look at my colleague and say, "Oh my God, we are all getting laid off in September. The whole group is being shut down and let go." Everyone panics and asks me how I know. My response, "I know. I heard. I know it's true." The information might have no basis in truth, none at all. It's a confabulation. I believe it's true, but it's really my fear combined with what might be a little bit of data, and it's dangerous. With the SFD, we need to stop and capture that first story, that conspiracy, that confabulation, that scribbled mess in our heads. "Oh my God, she looked at me like that in the meeting because she doesn't trust me. She thinks my ideas are stupid, and she's probably plotting to get me taken off this project." It's incredibly important to grab hold of those before the myth-making gets completely out of control. Today, I try to use my phone to capture my SFD before I act on it. I write it out when I have the opportunity simply because 70% of the risers we interviewed write down their SFDs. Nothing elaborate, just some notes, just the story I'm making up, maybe one sentence, my emotions, my body, my thinking, my beliefs, my actions. James Pennebaker, a researcher at the University of Texas at Austin, has found that because our minds are designed to try to understand things that happen to us, translating messy, difficult experiences into language essentially makes them graspable. Storytelling is another vehicle for sharing the story you're making up. If you have a friend or colleague you trust who has the skills and patience to listen, you can talk through your SFD. What's interesting is that writing down your SFD doesn't give it power. It gives us power. It gives us the opportunity to say, does this even make sense? Does this even look right? Writing slows the winds and calms the seas. And if you're completely mortified by the thought of someone finding your SFD because it's blamey and pissy and immature and a full-on rant, that means you've done it well. Unfiltered is powerful when it comes to the SFD. Margaret Atwood writes, when you're in the middle of a story, it isn't a story at all, but only a confusion, a dark roaring, a blindness, a wreckage of shattered glass and splintered wood, like a house in a whirlwind, or else a boat crushed by the icebergs or swept over the rapids, and all aboard are powerless to stop it. It's only afterwards that it becomes anything like a story at all, when you're telling it to yourself or to someone else. To move from what Atwood calls a wreckage of shattered glass and splintered wood to a true story that you can address, these are the questions that risers need to rumble with. Number one, what more do I need to learn and understand about this situation? What do I know objectively? What assumptions am I making? Number two, what more do I need to learn and understand about the other people in the story? What additional information might I need? What questions or clarifications could help? Then we get to the more difficult questions, the ones that take courage and practice to answer. Number three, what more do I need to learn and understand about myself? What's under this response? What am I actually feeling? What part did I play? Answering number one and number two means having the courage to address the conspiracies and confabulations. Answering number three requires emotional literacy, being able to recognize and name emotions, the same skill set required in empathy and self-compassion. Imagine how powerful it would be to catch ourselves making up an SFD, rumble with it for a few minutes, then check it out with a colleague. Hey, tough meeting today. You were quiet, and I'm making up that you were pissed about your team having to do all the work for the next sprint. Can we talk about that? Hey, FYI, if you walked up to me and said that, my trust and respect for you would skyrocket. Let's say that my response is, no, I'm not mad at all. I'm exhausted. Charlie's sick and he's throwing up all last night, but I appreciate you checking in. Even this gives you the opportunity to practice empathy. God, I'm sorry, that's hard. Can I get you a cup of coffee? Now, let's walk through the situation of this alternative reply. What if you came up to me and said that, and my answer was, yeah, I'm super frustrated. This is not our project, and we don't have the resources to own all the work. It's total bullshit. That gives you the opportunity to say, okay, let's sit down and talk about it. Win-win. Either way, this is connecting and trust building. It sounds like a cure for lunatic behavior, but this making up stories and conspiracy theories is something we all do. Gottschall writes, conspiracy is not limited to the stupid, the ignorant, or the crazy. It is a reflex of the storytelling mind's compulsive need for meaningful experience. The problem is that rather than rumbling with vulnerability and staying in the uncertainty, we start to fill in the blanks with our fears and worst-case scenario planning. I love this line from Gottschall. To the conspiratorial mind, shit never just happens. The power of the story I'm telling myself is that it reflects a very real part of what it means to be a meaning-making human. It's disarming because it's honest. We all do it. This is why it works across diverse environments and with all people. For example, we recently facilitated the Daring Leadership Program at Shell with an elite deep sea engineering team called SURF, Subsea Umbilical Risers and Flow Lines. GT was the leader we worked with at SURF, and he bravely led his executive leadership team through the work. Like GT, who has a PhD in aerospace engineering, most of the leaders were engineers or project managers. Part of the focus of our work together was examining how their leaders give performance feedback or lead setback debriefs as directives rather than facilitating conversations that lead to a deeper understanding of skill gaps, communication issues, and structural barriers. After spending time drilling down on the differences between systemic vulnerability, which is not good, and relational vulnerability, which is the prerequisite for courageous leadership, the team started building skills that enabled them to engage in difficult conversations with one another and their direct reports. Speaking to this new skill set, GT writes, "We have been able to achieve more constructive performance feedback sessions after learning the rising skills of reality checking the stories we all make up during conflicts or setbacks. Circling back has also allowed us to gain clarity and minimize the negative emotion that often frames the feedback process. By surfacing dilemmas swiftly and constructively, leaders can help resolve conflicts in a timely manner. This is critically important given the complex and high-risk environments where we work." Here's the thing. Without real conversation around feedback, there is less learning and more defensiveness. Because it's human nature to turn on some level of self-protection when dealing with setbacks and receiving feedback, it's important to circle back with employees to ensure that the intention of the message matched what was actually heard and to reality check SFDs. And for organizations that use a forced ranking system in employee evaluations, it's essential to create a culture in which circling back and checking out stories is safe and built into the evaluation process. You can do this by scheduling two meetings, one for the initial conversation and one for the story checking. Another example comes from Melinda Gates, whom you met earlier. Melinda is someone who often sees curiosity and asking the right questions as a leadership superpower, and her story resonated deeply with me. She writes, "For the longest time, the story I was making up was, that expert is ignoring me or condescending to me because I'm not Bill. But after years of feeling that sting, I started to realize that something else was underneath. I was worried that I didn't know enough science to lead world-renowned experts in global health. And it kept me from asking questions and from fully engaging. I was feeling like an imposter in a new field in which I didn't have a degree. Once I was able to face the fact of my insecurity, I was able to start chipping away at it. What I now believe is I know just the right amount, enough to ask good questions and not so much as to be distracted by minute details. Rewriting that story means that I feel confident asking seemingly stupid questions because I've learned that they are rarely stupid and often the most important ones to raise." I think both GT and Melinda's stories are great examples of finding the courage to own hard things so we can write new endings. In addition to affecting trust and connection in relationships and teams, the stories we tell ourselves can also crush our self-worth. The three most dangerous stories we make up are the narratives that diminish our lovability, divinity, and creativity. The reality check around our lovability: just because someone isn't willing or able to love us doesn't mean that we're unlovable. The reality check around our divinity: no person is ordained to judge our divinity or to write the story of our spiritual worthiness. And the reality check around our creativity: just because we didn't measure up to some standard of achievement doesn't mean that we don't possess gifts and talents that only we can bring to the world. And just because someone failed to see the value in what we can create or achieve doesn't change its worth or ours. The delta. The difference, the delta, between what we make up about our experiences and the truth we discover through the process of rumbling is where the meaning and wisdom of this experience live. The delta holds our key learnings. We just have to be willing to walk inside our stories and rumble. In the ham foldover debacle, I had to rumble with shame, vulnerability, and trust. My key learnings: number one, when I'm struggling and things are falling apart, I am much more likely to shame and blame myself. I can't think of even one instance where Steve has done that to me. Number two, I have to get better at asking for help. Number three, I sometimes offload emotion. I'm especially good at bouncing hurt with anger.